From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, residents hear rumors fly in rural Shiawassee County about a possible huge development, but...
We went to the township meeting to get more information. He told us he can't tell us because of a non-disclosure agreement.
Just what voice do neighbors have in potential developments?
So while public input certainly is taken, public elected officials can decide to not listen to that input.
Historian Thomas Segrue on the roots of the Detroit Rebellion of 67.
A long, tense, and unresolved history of conflict between Detroit's overwhelmingly white police force and its African-American population.
And a political game of chicken over an appeals court nomination. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Later in this hour, we hear about a possible huge development in rural Shiawassee County. Many residents are angry or worried because their local officials can't or won't give them information about what might be coming. But first, we've got ourselves a game of political chicken to talk about. At stake is a seat on the Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. In May, President Trump nominated Michigan Supreme Court Justice Joan Larson for a seat on that federal appeals court. Almost immediately, some three dozen professors at the University of Michigan Law School, from liberals to conservatives, sent a letter to Michigan's two Democratic senators supporting her nomination. She used to teach at the U of M Law School. Others in Michigan's legal circles said they expected a zero controversy fast-track approval. But there seems to be a roadblock erected by Senators Stabenow and Peters. With us now are It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Zoe, there certainly seems to be very widespread praise for Joan Larson.
There are, from both Democrats and Republicans. As you mentioned, she was appointed to the Supreme Court by Republican Governor Rick Snyder, but she is very friendly with a Democrat on the court, Bridget Mary McCormick. They sit on it together. Both came from the University of Michigan Law School. So very interesting here that she's getting bipartisan support. But that, of course, is not enough, as you mentioned.
Absolutely not. And before we duck into what's going on, the Sixth Circuit, Rick, is a plum assignment because?
Well, because these judicial circuits are very important. They're the step that comes between the lower courts, the state-level district courts that we have in Grand Rapids, Detroit, Ann Arbor, Kalamazoo, Marquette. The Sixth Circuit is the next step on the way to the Supreme Court. And you might remember, back in 2014, that was the court that upheld Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage. It was the only circuit in the country that upheld a state's same-sex marriage ban. And so that sent the case and marriage bans in the circuit in Ohio, Tennessee, Kentucky off to be challenged before the U.S. Supreme Court. Now we're looking at this court. It's going to be taking on a lot of immigration cases that we're hearing about here right now. There's an active case. They ruled not long ago on some aspects of Michigan's sex offender registry. So, this is a consequential position. And it's one that's supposed to go to someone from Michigan. She's replacing Judge David McKeague, and his predecessor was from Michigan. This is supposed to be a Michigan seat.
So how has this nomination turned into a game of political chicken, Rick?
Well, what we have seen is there's a process known as the blue slip, and it's about 100 years old. And what it does is it's a courtesy to home state senators, Democrat or Republican. It doesn't really matter who's in the majority traditionally. And they get to kind of give a thumbs up or thumbs down on a nominee or prospective nominee from their state. Well, Senators Peters and Stabenow, both Democrats, have not turned in their blue slips.
And Zoe, the shoes
holding
on the other
things up.
Holding things up. And as that old saying goes, the shoe's on the other foot, because didn't we see this happen in Kentucky last year in the Sixth Circuit?
Well, right. So what's happening, you've got Republicans sort of up in arms calling, these two Democratic senators out. Hey, let's move this forward. There was even an ad that came out about it. And the fact is, yes, this has happened before, as you mentioned, in Kentucky. President Obama just last year nominated a Kentucky Supreme Court justice to a seat on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And senators, Republican senators Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, did not return their blue slips. And it wasn't until President Trump became President Trump and nominated a different judge that something like just 8 days later, they then suddenly, you know, fixed their blue slips and turned them in on time.
Well, let's take a quick listen to this bit of the commercial run by this conservative group called the Judicial Crisis Network.
She applies the law, not a political agenda. So why aren't Senators Stabenow and Peters supporting her nomination to the U.S. Court of Appeals? Partisan politics.
Well, Rick, have either Senator Stabenow or Senator Peters talked about why they just haven't been able to find those blue slips yet?
Well, they say they're doing their due diligence and they're going through a lot of the material that got turned in. They say part of the problem is that the White House did not consult with them in advance about the Larson nomination, and so that's held things up. The White House disputes that, by the way. But it was really a lot to expect after, you know, what we saw with the Merrick Garland nomination last year and all of that, that any judicial appointment, especially one that comes from Donald Trump's list of prospective United States Supreme Court nominees, wouldn't get bogged down in at least some partisan politics.
So isn't this the kind of political gamesmanship voters across the country say, we're sick of this congressional gridlock?
Yes.
So could this backfire?
Yes.
Well, they're sick of the congressional gridlock when the party that's causing the gridlock is from the other side.
And that's the point here. I mean, what I was going to say is, yes, but how many folks are actually paying attention to this? I mean, if you go out in your community right now and say, hey, you know, what about those blue slips? I mean, most people are not going to be able to go, oh, yeah, let me tell you all about the politics of that. But yes, you're absolutely right, except, you know, there's always this thing that minority parties do, which is they, you know, wag their finger at the majority party and goes, that's not fair that you're doing that. Then, of course, it switches at some point and suddenly it's, well, wait, you did it. We get to do that. Another thing that I think, you know, voters are getting a little tired of, but it is, as Rick said, you know, this courtesy of the blue slips has gone back 100 years that we know of, maybe even more. The first time we've seen it was 1917. And the issue is, if they get rid of this, which Republicans could do right now, it's one more sort of that nuclear option, right? It's
yes.
One more courtesy and tradition, much like the filibuster that Democrats got rid of a few years ago, that it could suddenly just change because they want it to. And so it's this sort of game, as you said, of chicken that we're watching right now.
Or Game of Thrones.
I saw that face you made. I knew you were going to go there.
Game of Thrones for the Sixth Circuit. Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, as always, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
You bet.
Collaborative. Part of the community. It's the next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
Budget cuts for school districts are increasingly a way of life, and often the first things to go when money gets tight are music and art programs. But there is both anecdotal and scientific evidence that arts improve kids' overall learning in many ways. An art studio in Pontiac has taken on the mission of bringing back art for young people whose schools may or may not be able to afford it. Today's guest on The Next Idea is the director of the Art Experience in Pontiac, which is currently trying to boost its outreach program called Community Art Lab. Judy Wilson, welcome to The Next Idea. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What do kids miss out on, Judy, when their schools just can't afford to give them art classes?
The arts develop skills that businesses and corporations are finding in short supply. By cutting the arts, we deny children important tools for successful careers, really. To play with art elements, whether it's visual arts, movement, music, creative writing, theater, actually engages cognitive processes that are often underutilized in our current academic settings. Some of the skills that are developed are abstract and critical thinking, whole picture thinking, so being able to see how seemingly unrelated things fit together to form a whole, which is really a building block of not only problem solving, but the ability to identify the problem and then to solve it. And that's also important to budding scientists, architects, entrepreneurs.
So the idea that the skills that youngsters acquire by being exposed to art translates to just about any job that you can think of. So what is the art experience and how is it working to address that gap in Pontiac?
Well, the art experience was founded 21 years ago. It's a community art studio improving lives through the arts. And as the name suggests, we wanted to promote and provide access to art experiences. The arts, they're often perceived as elitist or financially or culturally inaccessible to many in our community. Or people think since they can't draw a straight line, they aren't good at it, and so the arts aren't for them. So we found a storefront in downtown Pontiac and began chipping away at these perceptions. We welcomed everyone into our studio, served people of all levels of ability and all walks of life, and we advocated for greater access to the arts for everyone in our community. And what we began to observe was a community coming together around the arts, true community, with everyone working side by side, label free.
And then this youth program, Community Art Lab, how does that work?
Community Art Lab is really our response to the increased cuts in arts and education and too few affordable opportunities for youth in our area to be creative. So we do this by forming relationships with the schools or human service agencies and through community programs. So these programs are basic fine art classes, and what we're developing right now is a multimedia workshop that will allow youth to tell their own story. So it's integrating creative writing, visual arts, videography, and digital learning to create mini monologues to be shared with their community. And our CrowdRise site will allow us to do that for agencies and schools that don't have it in their budget to do so on their own.
It strikes me this is something that organizations all around the state could be able to follow, this model of yours.
Yeah, I think it would be very easy to replicate this.
And what could that mean for the state?
You know, it's really kind of limitless. If we provide the youth learning through the arts, they are going to be able to make more use of all the skills that they're learning across their curriculum. This idea of actually providing youth tools to be creative, to help them practice designing their projects and leading the projects and then sharing it with the community, those are all important work-related skills and just life skills in general.
Judy Wilson is the director of the Art Experience in Pontiac. Thanks so much for being with us on The Next Idea, Judy.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, historian Thomas Sugrue on the Detroit Rebellion of 1967.
African Americans who were the first or second to move into predominantly white neighborhoods were subject to vandalism, window breaking, and all sorts of attacks as white neighbors gathered and tried to drive them out.
That comes up in 20 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just what is happening in the Shiawassee County town of Durand and in Vernon Township? That's what anxious residents are wondering as word spreads that something big could be coming. Something they hear could be a huge manufacturing facility. But people in Durand and Vernon Township aren't getting much information from their elected officials as to what that something might be and how it might change life in this very quiet rural area. With us now is Dr. William Foster. He's a veterinarian and president of Greater Durand Area Citizens for Responsible Growth. Dr. Foster, welcome.
Thank you.
What first tip people off that something, I'm using air quotes here, is being proposed for land just outside the Durand city limit?
Well, we first heard about it through the local television station, and that was the first we really heard of it. Then there was a post on Facebook and social media, things of that nature, and then there was an article in the local newspaper.
Well, what is the it that you're hearing?
The it that we're hearing is that this is a steel manufacturing facility. This information comes directly from Bert DeClerg, who is the Vernon Township supervisor. He has the information of what the name of the company is, exactly what this project is going to entail, but he is bound by a non-disclosure agreement from making that public. So that throws up red flags for everyone in this area. So we went to the township meeting to get more information. He told us he can't tell us because of a non-disclosure agreement. The little bits of information we are getting is coming from Vernon Township supervisor. They had a handout with talking points and some basic information on what this facility is going to be, i.e. the size of it, that is supposed to be 6,200 feet long by 3,800 feet wide. That's going to be the main building. You run the numbers, that's almost 24 million square feet. That is mind-boggling for anyone that would be living in this area to have that in your front or backyard.
So you're getting snippets of information from the Vernon Township supervisor. How about Duran City officials?
They're mum. They haven't said anything. They basically have said that we don't know any information. That came from their last city council meeting. The next city council meeting will be, I believe, on the 17th. So hopefully they will have more information at that time, although I am not holding out a lot of hope for that. It's been very hush-hush and very quiet.
Well, let me ask you, do you think, is this some kind of tug of war between Vernon Township officials and Duran City officials, or is everyone on the same page? What's your sense?
That is an excellent question, because past history has shown that there has been a tug of war between Vernon Township and the city of Duran through annexation initiatives, things of that nature that didn't go according to the way the city wanted it to. So there's been some back and forth between the city and Vernon Township. Right now, I'm unsure whether they are together on this or if there is a tug of war. There's a new city manager that was just hired in the last 6 or 8 months. She seems very bright and very energetic. So there's been a change in the leadership in the city of Duran. So I don't know if that's related to this proposed facility or not. So, again, a lot of unknowns and very good questions that we don't have answers to.
As people in Duran and people in Vernon Township talk about this, I know there's a very, very active Facebook page with the Greater Duran Area Citizens for Responsible Growth.
Right.
What kinds of information is being shared, or even more to the point, what are the fears?
The fear is the size and scope of the facility itself. Primarily, this is an agricultural area. The Shiawassee County Master Plan indicates, and its overarching theme is the preservation of agriculture in Shiawassee County. Something of this scale, something of this size, would definitely alter the agricultural nature of Vernon Township and Shiawassee County. So we're concerned about losing farmland. We're concerned about environmental issues with a steel manufacturing facility and being right in our backyard. It would be the third largest manufacturing facility in the world, according to what I found. That is just mind-boggling for residents in this area.
And where did you find that?
That was just a simple Google search for size of manufacturing facilities. I don't have access to deep information, but just a cursory Google search running the numbers at 24 million square feet, that's bigger than the gigafactory in Nevada that Tesla's building.
Now, are there any people going, wait, hang on a minute, what about jobs and boosting the tax base? Are there people that see merit in possibly having a big plant?
Absolutely there are, and I understand and respect that outlook. The thing is, it would be such a radical departure from what we're used to here. It would just totally change the nature of where we physically live. For the residents that live around here, that's a game changer. That's a game breaker, if you will, for us. And yes, other people that don't live physically live right here, I can see where they're coming from. And I do respect that opinion, but it would just change things in such a radical way that we are not in favor of it.
I'm just wondering, is it unanimous among the community in Duran or in Vernon Township, or are there factions forming where people say, no, hey, wait a minute, we could use the work. Yeah, so where do you see that going with factions dividing?
Well, that's what's very troubling, because it's sort of splitting our community. We're a tight-knit community. These farms around here and businesses like my own business, my great-grandfather started it 103 years ago, so it's been passed down from generation to generation. Similar to many of the farms in this area, they've been passed on from generation to generation. So that's what we know. The people around here have been here for generations. We're friends and neighbors. We've lived here for our whole lives, and our families have been here. So it's kind of this, as you mentioned before, a tug of war or sort of butting heads in this community. And that's troubling, because we have been close for the most part.
Now, has anything, Dr. Foster, moved beyond the rumor stage? I mean, has property been bought? Have applications been made? Have property owners gotten offers?
From what I understand, there have been purchase options that have been placed. We don't know exactly who is putting these options. We do know that the local realty company is acting as the broker. But yes, they have started the purchase agreement part of this, and that's where this stage is. It is in this preliminary gathering enough land to actually start the permitting process and the zoning process and that. From what I understand, they don't have all of the property that they need to put this footprint down. So there are landowners that have not signed purchase agreements. But yes, they have started that process.
I've seen on the Facebook page, I've seen the name Project Tim. Mm-hmm. What does that name mean?
I do not know.
Who coined that term?
That was from the developers, and according to Bert DeClerc, that's what they have named this project.
Where do you see this going, Dr. Foster?
Well, hopefully it doesn't come in, but we're just going to have to wait and see. We're in this phase of trying to get folks organized to support and encourage responsible growth. We want to support landowner rights in Vernon Township. Right now we're in this waiting game, or a waiting phase, if you will, just to see whether the company can actually secure property that they need. From what I understand and from what Bert DeClerc said, the township supervisor, if they can't secure the whole footprint, then they won't break ground. They won't do the project here. And according to him, they have other sites that they are considering. So this may move to a different area.
Dr. William Foster, president of the Greater Durand Area Citizens for Responsible Growth. The group is keeping an eye on a possible development in Shiawassee County near Vernon Township and the city of Durand. Dr. Foster, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
What is local government's role here? We turn now to Rex Lamore. He's director of the Michigan State University Center for Community and Economic Development. Rex, just how common is the situation these folks in Shiawassee County find themselves in?
Well, in fact, in an economic development context, it's not uncommon for a developer or an investor to do some preliminary assessment of the potential for a development to occur in a particular area. And in so doing, they will often ask for a non-disclosure agreement that allows them to determine the process that is likely to occur over the next several months as if the proposal goes forward, but also reduces the potential for speculation. Generally, non-disclosure agreements between public and private entities occur when there is some public interest that might be protected. For example, the purchase of land by a public entity, if it was known that it was likely to be resold or redeveloped in some higher value use, you see a lot of speculation occurring, increasing the value of that property, you know, way beyond what its current value might be. And so an NDA is really not that unusual in the early processes of development.
And I guess the question is, what is early, and at what point should people start getting information? Do they deserve a voice before agreements are kind of nailed down and the ship has sailed, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. And that would be entirely expected, that the community will have an opportunity to give input and guidance on the actual final decision, either through the environmental impact statements that might need to be generated or any public subsidies that may be included in the development proposal, any road, sewer, infrastructure investments. There will be opportunity for public comment and input. However, the final agreement actually does, the final decisions generally reside within the elected officials. So while public input certainly is taken, public elected officials can decide to not listen to that input if they don't believe it's in the best interest of the community and make an alternative choice. That usually ends up in a court case, but it's certainly their prerogative because the final decision makers are the local elected officials.
So really the accountability would then happen at the ballot box?
Yes, at some future date after
yes.
If the development goes forward. And that's certainly the controlling factor within the elected official's mind. If I intend to run for re-election and I go against the public will, I may pay the price at the ballot box.
It does strike me, as we kind of circling back to these NDAs, the non-disclosure agreement, this, in trying to avoid speculation, land speculation, you're trying to save taxpayer money, aren't you?
Correct. That's the public interest that is served in keeping this kind of information for a certain period of time private, but it doesn't allow any final decisions to be made presumably. Those all have to come into the public view and the public arena for public comment. So, yes, it's in the past, that's historically what they've been used for.
Rex, at what point must local officials take the wraps off and put it all out there for the public to be able to comment?
At the point at which the developer is ready to ask for any public action, for example, if there is a rezoning that may need to occur at the land, or a variation in the current land use ordinance, or an allocation of any public resource, any funding of infrastructure or other investments that would, you know, involve taxpayer funds, at the point where the developer is asking for that consideration, it will come into the public domain.
So people who are worried that this thing is going to be a done deal and they won't get a voice, you're saying that cannot happen?
Yes. That would be highly suspect. I mean, it's not, we are in Michigan, right? And there are cases where the laws have been broken, but that would be not normal procedure and highly unusual. I think the community is right to be aware of and maybe mobilizing itself around the issue and begin to prepare their questions and look for their interest in the development proposal. They might be well served by thinking about things like a community benefit agreement that might also go along with the development proposal. So early knowledge is generally a good thing.
You got to ask what recourse the people have who want to preserve their rural way of life. I mean, could residents do anything? You say court cases could happen, right, to try to stop this in their tracks if they really wanted to?
If it's a permitted use under the current land use zoning, under the current ordinances of the community, then the public interest to exercise control over private activity is fairly constrained if it's a by right use. Now, if they need to ask for some exception, the private interest, either a rezoning or a variation, then, of course, the public interest can be more strongly asserted. But in the United States, we give a lot of strength to private ownership of land and the right of private landowners to do what they want. The only assuring way that you can to control any land use outside of your own land is through purchase of the land or conserving it in some other form of ownership. So it's very difficult for the public, without due course and due reason, to take away a private right of use.
It does strike me that it is a pretty tough balancing act for local officials between courting big development that, you know, they hope can create jobs and boost the tax base, so it'll be a boon to the area, and also being accountable and transparent to citizens.
Yes, that is an important issue that we need to, you know, the public subsidy of private interests when there are allocation of public resources is clearly an area that requires substantial public scrutiny and concern. So it is a major issue. And the scale of this proposed development, at least the way it's being articulated, suggests that it will have a substantial transformation of the character of the community. A development of that scale in another environment, in another community where there's already been major industrial or development of that scale, probably wouldn't see that kind of response. But picking a small rural, primarily rural area, and transforming it into a major industrial hub, it could have a potentially a major effect on the quality of life in that community.
What have your thoughts been as you've looked over, you know, the information that's available so far? I mean, what might be coming? I mean, the size of the proposal, and what do you think as you look at this?
Well, Ms. Canty, we can all speculate, right? I mean, if the numbers are anywhere close to accurate, I mean, this is a major private investment, and I've heard some talk of the possibility of a steel plant. That seems highly unusual, but it's possible. But there may be some other sort of development proposal. It's pretty substantial, though. Durand, however, does occupy a very unique place in the state. It has that train connection. It has that I-69 corridor connection. It sits between two manufacturing hubs, Flint and Lansing. Also has access to Detroit through that I-75 link up in Flint. So it is a unique area that could, you know, this site could be highly valued by a private industry.
We will all stay tuned and check back in with you to kind of pick your brain as things develop with Project Tim. Rex Lamore, Michigan State University Center for Community and Economic Development. Rex, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, and thank you.
We reached out to Durand City Manager Colleen O'Toole for comment, and here's what she had to say about the project.
Our community is very fortunate to be considered as a location for this opportunity. Thus far, the developers have displayed a commitment to being environmentally conscious, hiring veterans and local tradespeople, sourcing materials from other Michigan suppliers, and in their own words, being a great neighbor. We look forward to full public participation process in the near future and to working with representatives in neighboring communities to ensure that the final project benefits the region as a whole.
That is Durand City Manager Colleen O'Toole. Coming up, we examine one of the deadliest urban uprisings in U.S. history and its lingering effects 50 years later on Detroit.
Between 1948 and 1963, Detroit loses somewhere in the ballpark of 130,000 manufacturing jobs. And this is before the events of 67 or before the rise of global competition in the auto industry.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks 50 years since a series of civil disturbances in cities across America rocked the nation. We'll be looking back on the summer of 1967 to try to better understand what happened then and what lessons we've learned since. Joining us to begin the conversation is Thomas Sugrue. He's a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University, and he's author of the landmark book, first published in 1996, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit. He spoke with Stateside's Lester Graham.
Let's start with just exactly what happened in Detroit in July of 1967.
July 67 began in Detroit, like many of the urban riots or uprisings, with a confrontation between the police and African Americans. In Detroit, it was a blind pig, an illegal after-hours bar that was busted by the police early on a Sunday morning, leading to a huge crowd gathering in the alley behind the bar, a lot of noise, people coming out on a hot summer night, and eventually taking to the street, 12th Street, on Detroit's west side, where they began to loot, burn buildings, and eventually kind of spark what would be a several-day uprising on the streets of Detroit.
So that was the spark, but that wasn't the cause. Why did we have that riot?
There's so many factors that fed into the riot in 67. One was a long, tense, and unresolved history of conflict between Detroit's overwhelmingly white police force and its African-American population. There had been clashes between the police and African Americans going back for decades, intensifying in the 1950s and 60s as the city's black population grew. As the police department began to crack down on crime, facing pressure from white Detroit residents, they often stopped and frisked and harassed African American men, particularly those who were driving through or walking through predominantly white sections of the city. That created a lot of tension, and it remained very much unresolved in 1967. But there were also bigger economic forces and bigger patterns of discrimination and segregation that were at play. Black Detroit and white Detroit were entirely separate pretty much in 1967. That is, the city was highly segregated by race. Large sections of Detroit were home to almost all African Americans, and vice versa. Large sections of the outlying neighborhoods in Detroit and the suburbs were nearly entirely white. And that separation led to resentment, a lack of opportunity, particularly on the housing market, and mutual distrust between whites and African Americans. It's you can't underestimate the intensity of that segregation in housing and the role that it played in dividing metropolitan Detroit by race.
The reputation of the city at that time, in 1967, Detroit was considered to be a model of racial harmony. African Americans in Detroit were financially better off than black folks in other large cities. A high rate of home ownership, a low rate of poverty, relatively speaking. What did the pundits at the time not understand?
What they didn't understand is that there was a big gap, despite the fact that many African Americans in Detroit had solid working class jobs, a big gap between the reality of everyday indignity on the streets, in the neighborhoods, in the stores, and the rhetoric of full racial equality and inclusion. And that gap, that yawning gap, was one that frustrated a lot of folks.
This was not the first time racial tensions boiled over in Detroit. During World War II, white and black people from the South migrated to Detroit as factories ramped up for military production. There was a race riot in 1943. What caused that, and what did that look like?
That riot in 1943 was really different from 1967. It happened as the city's black population was increasing substantially, and conflicts occurred in public space where African Americans and whites jostled together, particularly on public transit, where there were lots of minor clashes. Also, an intense suspicion of black newcomers to the city and a fear by whites that these new black folks coming in were stealing their jobs, taking away their opportunities. So that riot broke out on a hot summer day, as they usually do, on the Belle Isle Bridge, a place where at least 100,000 people had gone that day to cool off, and fights broke out between blacks and whites, and soon folks took to the street. But in this case, in 43, the instigators of the uprising were overwhelmingly white, attacking African Americans, pulling them off of buses and streetcars, beating them up, and it was much more of a pitched battle between black and white compared to 1967, which was a very different phenomenon.
A running battle through the streets, as I've been told. The Detroit disturbances were the most violent of those in 1967. President Lyndon Johnson appointed a presidential commission, the Kerner Commission, to find out why the violence happened and how to prevent further outbreaks of violence. What did the Kerner Commission find?
The Kerner Commission was Johnson's effort to really make sense out of the long, hot summer of 67. Detroit was one of 163 small towns, suburbs, and cities that exploded in uprising or rebellion in the summer of 67, and they wanted to make sense of it. The report, which was published in 1968, found that the underlying causes were that America was two societies, one black and one white, separate and unequal. But then getting away from that big proclamation, they went down into the nitty-gritty and documented intentions between blacks and the police, segregation, disparities in economic opportunity. And they drew from a mountain of interviews with residents of cities that exploded in 67, with participants in the uprisings, with observers, with police officers, with public officials. And the evidence was overwhelming that America had not, despite all of its rhetoric of colorblindness and despite some civil rights legislation, had not fundamentally addressed the root problem central to the country's history, which is racial inequality.
And the report was blunt about it, saying these civil disturbances happened because of white attitudes toward people of color. How did the government and society at large react to the Kerner Commission's report?
Well, the Kerner Commission report was an unlikely bestseller. It was released in a cheap paperback version, and it sold millions of copies. It was controversial. Lyndon Johnson distanced himself from the findings. He was concerned about a growing insurgency of white voters calling for law and order. Many police departments were skeptical or critical of the report's frank discussion of police harassment and brutality. On the other hand, many social scientists and scholars and investigative journalists used the report as a springboard for more detailed investigations into what was happening in the cities. And it led to an outburst in the late 60s and early 1970s of concern for unaddressed urban problems. And so it became kind of a template for a reform agenda, including in places like Detroit.
I want to look at the larger picture in a second, but a common narrative is that the 1967 riots marked the beginning of the decline of Detroit. Your book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, meticulously details how that just isn't true. What really happened to Detroit?
Yeah, it's still solidified conventional wisdom that all of Detroit's problems began in the late 1960s. Detroit was affected by several big changes that were taking place simultaneously. First was the hemorrhaging of manufacturing jobs and of the city's retail base. That began not in 1967 or in the 1970s, but really in the early 1950s as the auto industry and parts companies and suppliers began to relocate to other parts of the country, increasingly rural areas and suburbs and small towns, in search of cheap labor and more land. At the same time, the auto industry is introducing new technologies to save labor, and jobs are beginning to disappear. So between 1948 and 1963, Detroit loses somewhere in the ballpark of 130,000 manufacturing jobs. And this is before the events of 67 or before the rise of global competition in the auto industry. That's one. The second is that Detroit is a city plagued by racial segregation and conflict. The discrimination in Detroit's housing market is not the result of birds of a feather flocking together or the freedom of choice in the housing market. Rather, African Americans had very few options in metropolitan Detroit because of federal housing policy that was explicitly discriminatory, because real estate brokers would not show homes to African Americans in predominantly white sections of the city or the suburbs, and because white Detroiters themselves fiercely resisted the movement of the first African Americans into their neighborhoods. I found in my own research and for Origins of the Urban Crisis that more than 200 African Americans who were the first or second to move into predominantly white neighborhoods were subject to vandalism, window breaking, and all sorts of attacks as white neighbors gathered and tried to drive them out.
And looking at the grievances outlined by the current commission report, you find by many measures, things for black residents in Detroit are actually worse than they were in 1967. Poverty is worse. Joblessness is worse. The schools are worse. Home ownership among black residents is lower. About the only thing that's better in Detroit are the relations between the police and black residents. What does that all tell you?
It all tells me that the issues that the Kerner Commission raised after the 67 events remain mostly unresolved. That is, to a great extent in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, American cities fell to the bottom of the national public policy agenda. They fell to the bottom of state agendas in Lansing. It became harder and harder for places like Detroit to get the kind of support for rebuilding its decaying infrastructure, for shoring up its schools. And increasingly, the city relied on its own tax base, which was shrinking dramatically as the population declined and as businesses continued to disappear.
What do you think we should have learned in the wake of 1967's civil disturbances?
We should have learned that if we're going to prevent long-term racial conflicts, we have to get to the core issues. We can't put on Band-Aids, which is by and large what we've tended to do. Let's have a conversation about race, which has happened again and again in the period from the 1960s to the present, with hopes that somehow that's going to lead to a change. Or let's increase the representation of African Americans in visible kind of places like ads and the media. Those kinds of things alone will not get at the root problems, which is the ways in which power and resources and jobs and economic opportunity are still really unequally distributed across metropolitan areas. They won't get to the core problems of public education, which is that we have really separate and unequal systems of schooling in metropolitan Detroit that really limit people's opportunities. It won't get to the still really, really deeply entrenched patterns of residential segregation. It's better than it was in 1967 in terms of segregation, but Detroit still ranks among the top five most racially segregated metropolitan areas in the United States, and we haven't done very much to grapple with that.
What do you think is an appropriate way to mark the 50th anniversary of the civil disturbances of 1967, the uprising in Detroit?
Well, I'll put in a pitch for the Detroit 67 project at the Detroit Historical Society. Go visit. They've done an extraordinary job in trying to show 67 from a wide variety of different vantage points, from a suburban living room to a store being looted, from the perspective of folks who were on the streets the police. They've really tried to show that what happened in 67 was really complicated and interesting and varied, and one's perceptions of it varied a lot depending on where you lived, where you worked, what your racial background was. And I think they've done a brilliant job in making those events come alive.
Thomas Segrew is professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University and author of The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit. It's been a real privilege talking with you.
Thank you.
The chaos that happened that week in July 1967 is often referred to as the Detroit Riot. But in recent years, many black Detroiters have come to prefer the term rebellion. Grace Lee Boggs was a civil rights activist in Detroit for many, many decades. In an essay written for the 40th anniversary of 1967, Boggs explained why what happened that summer was not a riot, but a real, if unfocused, rebellion against racial oppression.
July 1967 was not just a riot or just a breakdown of law and order, as the media still call it. It was a righteous rising up against a police occupation army and against the injustice of white power governing a city becoming majority black. In other words, it was a rebellion, as most Detroit blacks called it at the time. But it was not a revolution, because it did not begin to create the new values and new institutions that inner-city youth, who were the main actors in the rebellion, needed to give meaning to their lives now that high-tech and deindustrialization were making their labor expendable. This is not just a question of semantics. It's only by being clear that July 1967 and the other urban uprisings of the 60s were rebellions and not riots or revolutions that we can appreciate what they did and what they did not achieve. Because the urban rebellions were on such a huge scale, the establishment was forced to admit blacks to high positions in all kinds of institutions. This struck an important blow against racism, but it did not provide an answer to the chaos spreading in our inner cities. This would require the projection of a radical revolution in values, from a society idolizing economic growth to one honoring community and our relationships with one another. That is why we founded Detroit Summer 14 years ago, to involve young people in rebuilding, redefining, and re-spiriting the city from the ground up.
Grace Lee Boggs passed away in the fall of 2015, just a few months after her 100th birthday. And now let's hear from a woman who lived just two blocks from the epicenter of the rebellion. Pat Watts grew up in Virginia Park. She was 16 in July of 1967 and tells us what it was like when chaos broke out in her neighborhood.
Of course, you know, we came outside and there's like chaos. Chaos just everywhere, people everywhere. There were black people coming in from other neighborhoods, white people, Spanish people, all colors of people coming to loot and steal. Next thing you know, there's National Guard, and they would say you can't go to the store, you know, get in the house. There's a sniper on the building behind you. Get in the house. I see it as starting off as a rebellion, and once things began to happen, like shooting little boys in the back, because the little boy in the neighborhood was 11 years old. He was going into the 5 and 10 cent store to get what he could get, you know, and they shot him in the back. And he, you know, became paralyzed. That made people angry. And when they did finally clean it up, all we heard was promises of what they were going to develop and do with 12th Street. We're coming back. It's going to be this. It's going to be that. So all the promises that were made, they did one little strip mall right in that close area, and they did the apartment buildings. And other than that, nothing came back.
Audio of Pat Watts comes courtesy of the Detroit Historical Society. And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.